Okay, the request was to give the status of gravitational wave detectors, which is an immense job that I will only asymptote to. But what I'll try to do is give some flavor for developments in the bar community and the laser communities, which are most active right now, and some allusion to the coming future with LISA. First of all, there's a range of frequencies to be considered in spanning the spectrum of gravitational waves. We know that in astronomy and earth science, we use very many orders of magnitudes of electromagnetic waves to see what's going on. And I'm happy to report that there's fairly good coverage now planned over about 8 orders of magnitude in the gravitational wave spectrum with terrestrial and space-based detectors. In the band of LIGO and the other terrestrial detectors, what you're sensitive to primarily are the products of stellar gravitational collapse, either the collapses themselves or what the remnants get up to. In the case of LISA, you're looking at a band of frequencies that's far lower, which are either earlier points in the evolution of binaries or the actions of much larger systems, very massive black holes, for instance. The signature that's used in all of these gravitational wave detectors is about the same. Basically, if you think of a group of inertial frames inscribed in a circle, the action of a gravitational wave is to take that circle in inertial space into an ellipse. And the ellipticity of that ellipse, the relative strain produced, is the number we keep track of. And in the case of the terrestrial detectors, there are basically two techniques that are used. One is to build an interferometer of free masses, which is shown here, in which case one measures basically the difference between the semi-minor and semi-major axes of this ellipse directly. Or the other method of doing so is to use resonant bar detectors, the more traditional method, where the inertial frames move, the atoms are constrained by their neighbors from moving with those frames, apply forces and put energy into the bonds in the bar, and then as the wave dissipates away, that energy is released in the bar rings. So I already mentioned the original terrestrial detectors. They're still around and continue to be improved. It was in the 1960s that Joe Weber first proved that you could get one of these bars to give you oscillation at the level of room temperature, oscillation of the atoms in the bar. Since then, people have gone to very cold systems in cryogenic thermal shields, operated at a few degrees Kelvin. The bars are typically big aluminum structures or niobium structures and weigh several tons. And the typical frequencies that one sees are up in a band near a kilohertz. So this Auriga bar is got a couple of resonances centered at 900 hertz. And typically, over time, the bars have had very low frequency bandwidths. And so it really was a bell that would ring at a single frequency if any energy, broadband energy source, disturbed it. That has been steadily increasing to where the Auriga 1 run had tens of hertz, and they're now pushing that frequency up in the region of near 100 hertz. So the efforts there are to broaden the frequency range and reduce noise. But the size of these detectors is principally limited basically by the speed of sound across the detector. The newer generation are the free mass detectors, which are now online in the sort of sense that they were intended to be, as very large scale detectors of gravitational radiation. The idea is that you suspend mirrors, which act as your survey markers in space. And as the wave comes by, you expect one arm to expand relative to the other. The light, and these are typically stored in the arms, at least that is the case for the LIGO, Virgo, and Tama detectors. And we store light typically in those detectors for of the order of 100 bounces. And then we produce an interference of the light back on the beam splitter and cast what's called a dark fringe in this direction. Basically, we get constructive interference in the direction of this photodetector and constructive interference in the other. This has a wonderful mathematical property, which is that this signal here, which carries the gravity wave signal, pretty much only carries information about what's different between the interaction of the light and the two arms, which is exactly what the gravity wave signal would give us. Things that are common, information that's common about the two arms, like the maybe frequency shifts in the laser that are felt by both arms, or amplitude shifts in the laser felt by both arms, are rejected and sent back towards the light source. So there's a beautiful separation in this device between common mode and differential effects, which make these instruments really able to sing. The other thing I was going to mention is the size of the detectors is principally limited by the speed of light now, or if you're terrestrial based, on how much land you can get to build your detector on, realizing that the surface of the Earth is curved and your light goes straight. From the earliest days of the field back in the 70s, people dreamed of an international network of detectors, and that network is actually working now. And the components for the interferometers are the two LIGO interferometers, the GEO detector and Virgo detector in Europe, and the Tama detector in Japan. And then there's an Australian group working with a site in a site called Gingin. It's near Perth, where they could build eventually a 3-kilometer detector. The basic ideas of a network is catching the same signal in multiple detectors would boost your confidence in detecting weak signals, help you locate the sources, and get a decomposition of the polarization. So the components of the network are the LIGO component. At Hanford, Washington, we have 4-kilometer and 2-kilometer interferometers that share the same beam tube. This is a picture of the Hanford site. And then LIGO has, in Louisiana, outside of Baton Rouge, a 4-kilometer interferometer sharing quite similar facilities. And so those are the three LIGO interferometers. LIGO itself is funded by the National Science Foundation. Caltech and MIT operate the lab, but there are about 400, between 400 and 450 LIGO scientific collaboration members worldwide, many of whom are members of the other groups that I'll mention. In Europe, we have the GEO detector, a 600-meter facility near Hanover, Germany, built into an agricultural landscape. And in Italy is the other really big detector, the 3-kilometer Virgo detector, which is built near Cascina, which is somewhat outside of Pisa. There are also interferometers in Asia and Australia at the National Astronomical Observatory of Japan is the 300-meter Tama 300 detector. And in Australia right now, there's just an 80-meter interferometer. And that's used as a high-power test facility for upgrades to the LIGO interferometers. But this site, as I said before, could support a 3-kilometer detector, and its location in the southern hemisphere would be very useful to a worldwide network. The BAR groups have also formed a network called the International Gravitational Event Collaboration, or IGEC, and there are BARs at LSU in the US, several BARs in Italy, and the Niobe BAR in Australia are members of the IGEC collaboration. And they've published a number of papers. There's a new limit coming out fairly soon on galactic sources by that group in PRD. One of the problems with all of these detectors is space-time is a very stiff place. And so you don't get an awful lot of curvature, even for waves that can carry away huge amounts of energy. And what we detect in the detectors is curvature. So for most people who do theoretical physics, that number to you is 8 pi. But for me, I forget about the 8 pi, that's trivial. I worry about what gives it its units. And when I plug in something that gives me the right units, which have to be units of 1 over newtons, that's what I get, are the physical things. And the gravitational constant over c to the fourth is a powerfully small number, which says that you don't get much curvature. And so the amount of amplitude you get for a given amount of energy in the source is reduced by this huge factor. And that's really the challenge for experimentalists of trying to do this. So when you boil those down into a real device, what you're looking at is trying to detect strains at Earth of maybe 10 to the minus 21, or hair's width at 4 light years. We don't have four light years to do it, so we have to measure down to much lower numbers, roughly 1/1000th of a proton diameter in 4 kilometer arms. A lot of other things flow from those requirements, controlling absolute arm lengths to 10 to the minus 13 meters, optical phase 10 to the minus 10 meters, alignments to 10 to the minus 8 radians. So these are very delicate devices. It takes a lot of engineering to make them fly. But what all detectors have in common of the broadband laser detectors is that there's typically a wall at low frequency set by the seismic noise as filtered by some seismic isolation system. This is typically a frequency of about 30 hertz, 35 to 40 hertz for LIGO. For Virgo, which has one of the most advanced low frequency types of vibration isolation, that number would be pushed down to about 10 hertz. Then at very high frequencies, you're limited by shot noise. How many photons could you dump if you tried to dump the photons in the interferometer in a time comparable to 1 over your period of your waveform? And then the mid-region where you're limited by Brownian motion of your 10 kilogram mirrors. The LIGO facilities were built to take a range. This is the curve for the initial LIGO. The facilities were built to take a range of detectors of ever-increasing sensitivity. So we place the limits that are inherent in the facility way out of range. So we hope for many, many years the facilities would not be the limiting factors. LIGO commissioning has been going steadily for quite some time now. We had the completion of our buildings in 1999, end of 99, when we had the inauguration of facilities in Livingston. Next quarter, a few months later, the longest Fabry Perot cavity in the world at 2 kilometers length was hanging and resonating. And then right after that, we started a series of engineering runs to test the technologies even as pieces of the interferometer were built and come under control. And even at this date when we've started science runs, we have not yet gotten the interferometers completely under control, as you'll see. But we've marched on over time to where now, at the end of 2002, last summer, we began the first of the science runs, and we've just completed the second science runs. And as you can see, the sensitivity and strain units of a typical interferometer have steadily dived over a pretty rapid rate. So we're now on the 10 to the minus 22 scale. What one of these detectors looks like is there's some type of vibration isolation system. Typically, it provides very good isolation above some frequency and no isolation below some other frequency, where you have to actually control the positions and orientations of the mirrors by applying forces to hold them still in space while the Earth sloshes around underneath them. And so in the LIGO case, what we do is we use cascaded layers of masses and springs to perform that function. This is what they look like in hardware. The springs are fairly ordinary looking in here, but when you cut them open, you see that they have internal shock absorbers inside of them, so they're a bit more complicated than your normal spring. This is what one type of optical table looks like, mounted in the system, and basically a little bit of data that shows that by the time you're up to a frequency a little over 30 hertz, you've got a factor of a million vibration isolation from Earth's vibrations, and that's enough to get you to where the major background in your observing band, mechanical background, will be from Brownian motion of the driven by the atoms in the interferometer. The mirror itself is a suspended mirror. It sits in what looks like a very robust cage. It's an actual robust cage, but it doesn't actually touch the mirror. The only parts touching the mirror are a very fine fiber, metal fiber in the case of LIGO, that loops once around the mirror and then ties to a clamp up here. And then we have some small magnet here glued to the mirror, and you'll see that there are these little cylindrical cores that carry a voice coil that can provide a magnetic field to drive that magnet to move the mirror. And also inside of it is a shadow sensor that can detect the shadow of that magnet and know how far it's driven. That's part of the ability to apply forces and know what you've done at low frequencies. Typical numbers, the mirror is balanced on a 30 micron fiber to about a degree of arc, static balancing, and then the drive currents can take it from there. The feedback and control of the mirrors is a kind of an interesting thing. It gives a feeling for the complexity of the devices. You have a number of functions to do when you start the interferometer out. You have no interference. You have mirrors that are just swinging wildly, and you have to bring them under control where you start to get fringes, and then you can stabilize on the fringes. So basically, you go through a set of functions. You damp the mirrors first to the vibration-isolated tables to take out the pendulum motion, but the tables themselves bounce. So then you damp the mirror angles, which you'll need, to the lab floor using optical levers mounted on piers to the lab floor. Similarly, you take the laser and you stabilize it, improving frequency and amplitude stability by factors of a few thousand over what they are in the commercial version of the laser. Then, at that point, you can actually start to see fringes. And you can start to lock onto those fringes and get stable resonances in various cavities throughout the interferometer. Once you have a stable fringe, and so the power is built up and saturated in the interferometer, then you can start to turn on your wavefront sensing control. This is an interferometric readout of the wavefronts that allow you to get fine precision on your mirror angles and really bring the system into a stable state. In the development of LIGO's commissioning, this is about the step we're on now. Overall, when you count them up, there's about 100 control systems that you have to tailor and make work well to keep one of these machines running. Just a nice piece of freshman physics. One of the things the mirror is supposed to do is be a good approximation to a free mass. And so a little experiment I did was to drive at different frequencies a sinusoidal excitation of the mirror using those coils and read out the position using the shadow sensors. And you basically get the transfer function shown here that you expect for a pendulum in the red dots. Blue is what I would get if I calibrated the data right. But the important curve, by the way, this is amplitude and this is phase. The important curve to compare it to is the turquoise curve. That's what F equals MA would give you. And so you see basically at frequencies above about 2 hertz, for this suspended mirror, it's indistinguishable from a free mass. And that's what we wanted to do. The frequency stabilization employs several stages where we feed back from parts of the interferometer. This is the raw laser table where we stabilize things down to a level about 1,000 times better than the commercial laser. And then bringing feedback from these tables, we can get about another factor of 10 to the 4 stabilization of the laser. And at that point, it's good enough to shine into the interferometer and do gravity wave detection. The pre-stabilized laser itself is this box over here. Physical size is about the drawer in your motel room. This would fit in it. A little bit of the light output from this 10-watt IR laser, it's 1 micron light. That's light that a security camera would see, but your eye would not. That light comes out. A little bit of it is compared in wavelength to the length of a temperature stabilized cavity formed by several mirrors with a quartz spacer, stabilized to a millidegree Kelvin. And that's sort of the wavelength reference for the experiment. And then the bulk of it is driven through this triangular cavity formed by these three mirrors, which filter the light and give it a beautiful disc-like shape, unlike what most laser beams would look like. One of the problems with locking these interferometers, the act of getting them to actually fill with light and stabilize them, is that you have to get the system of many coupled cavities to do the right steps to quiet things down. And that's most and best done, most easily and best done, with a lot of tailoring of the operations. This is not something easy for a human to do. And so we've gone over to a fully digital control system here. So basically, we sample light at a photodetector in a few places. You know, this is the analog world to here. Then the signals are brought in on an analog to digital converter to a computer. And the rest of the massaging is done with C codes until eventually we have exactly the tailoring of the signal we need to feed back. And we put a signal out to basically a fairly simple analog coil driver, which drives the currents for those coils that then drive the mirrors. This is just an example of one of the screens. You can see it's got lots of parts, and each one of those buttons unloads another screen. There are about 5 layers of screens behind this just to run one of the mirrors in the interferometer. And so you can imagine that there's a lot of filtering that gets done there. But the beauty is a grad student with MATLAB can reconfigure this machine in about an hour. So why is locking difficult for these machines? Well, to get the light to build up at all in the interferometer, you got to get the mirrors to the right places, to roughly this precision, 10 to the minus 10 meters, roughly an atomic diameter. So the mirrors have to be in that position before light can build up at all. It doesn't necessarily mean it works right, but you've got much bigger influences around. One is a motion called the microseism, which is important in big detectors. It's not at all important in small labs. But when the lab becomes kilometers on a side, it becomes important. The microseism is driven by ocean waves. It's a vibration of the Earth's crust that's set up by standing waves out in the oceans. It has a period of about 8 seconds and an amplitude of about a micron per second, except when there are storms, when it can go up by factors of 30 or 40. The next effect that's really big is the Earth's crust is distorted by tides from the sun and the moon, and those are typically in the range of 100 to 300 microns. Remember, an interferometric fringe is half a micron. So these are big effects, and you can't run the machine without taking them out. So the way we take them out, the tides are a nice freshman physics problem, so we got a freshman from Caltech to come up one summer, and he wrote a program that predicts the tides and predicts as a simple model for the Earth's crust, and it basically spits out a couple of times a second where the buildings are. And inside on our vibration isolation systems, there's a piezoelectric crystal stuck, wedged into a hinge, and it pushes on the hinge and moves the vibration isolation stacks back and forth according to Eric Morgenson's program. I think Eric's graduating soon. But anyway, according to his program, those stacks move back and forth, and that program is pretty good. It takes out about 80 to 90% of that 100 microns, which gets it into the region where our voice coil actuators can pick it up. So that's the thing called feed forward that takes it down. And then that brings it to a region where we can measure it interferometrically because it doesn't blow us out of lock. And then we can apply the signals to the voice coils to take the signal down from there. The microseism is a similar challenge. It varies at the order of magnitude level over the course of a year. What we do there is we measure it with seismic equipment in each of the buildings. It's about an 8-second wave. We measure it, you know, for a while in the distant past, make our best guess what it's going to do for the next second or two, and feed ahead some forces to shake the vibration isolation system in the opposite direction, and that's good to knock it down factors of 5 to 10 when the effect is big, and that's what we need to do. Once we do that, it's within the range of our other controls. Having made all of this stuff work, we get up to the point where we conduct LIGO Science Run 1. That was a 17-day run at the end of last summer. Included the three LIGO interferometers in coincidence with the GEO-600 detector and about 2 days of overlap with TOMA 300. All these groups are still trying to commission their machines, and so it's, you know, their best efforts sometimes to coordinate a run don't always work out. But we got a couple of days when TOMA was able to be available. Joint analysis has been done with GEO and reported at the spring APS meeting. Papers are in progress. This is the configuration of GEO. Well, I show it because it's a little different than the other detectors. GEO does not have cavities in the arms. They do have power recycling like the LIGO machine and others have. They plan to implement, they have now implemented signal recycling, but this was not there in the first data run. But that's the GEO configuration. Sensitivity of GEO for that first set of science runs would be this blue curve down here, just breaking through to the 10 to the minus 20 strain per root hertz scale. And the LIGO interferometers were also basically down around 10 to the minus 20 to 10 to the minus 21, about a factor of 10 better, roughly. In this band of frequencies, the GEO was best at the higher frequency, so they were actually quite comparable at very high frequency. With that type of sensitivity, you can see another interesting piece of freshman physics, which is that you expect certain Brownian motion of the mirror due to the KT of energy that equipartition says goes into all the modes. This is the pendulum mode. And these are modes of the mirror squishing around. And what we do is we generally design these to be outside the observing band. So this is down at 1 hertz, this is above 10 kilohertz, so we don't see those. And then we design the parts to have very high mechanical Qs so that the energy gets sucked out of the wings because the integral's KT. So you suck the energy, you know, you have to conserve the energy as you narrow the resonance more and more of it pours into the resonant frequency as you go to higher mechanical Q, and it comes out of your observing band. The one case where you can't do it is the violin mode, where the wire has KT of energy, and 10 to the minus 5 of that leaks into the test mass. And that gives you a nice marker in your observing band of a known energy, roughly 20 millifermis. And so that's a nice signal that we first saw in the S2 run, was the 20 millifermi energy, thermal energy of the wires in LIGO. The range of the run astrophysically was enough to get us outside the Milky Way and just starting to include the Magellanic Clouds. This was for binary neutron star in spirals, which are our sort of standard candle that we typically use as a benchmark. LIGO Science Run S2 was, again, a joint run, this time with TAMA. It was held February 14th to April 14th. GEO had tried to participate but ran into some technical difficulties, had to drop out. That was a 4-interferometer run. Just to point out for GEO, they did run an S1 and they did get their signal recycling mirror in, but they had some problems with the curvature of the mirror not being quite what they expected, but they solved that, or were in the process of solving it with a nice clever device that was sitting in their quiver of tricks, which is to thermally distort the radius of curvature of the mirror by radiative heating. And that seems to have worked very nicely, but they weren't able to get the run up in time. However, TAMA, which is the world's longest running interferometer, was up, and that was data taking 8, where they ran with us for 2 months, rough frequency of a few 10 to minus 21 per root hertz. So that's what it looks like in frequency. Minimum frequency is sort of around 1 kilohertz for the TAMA detector. The red curve is the... That was just for TAMA. LIGO, you'll see next, is about a factor of 10 better. This is the LIGO sensitivity. This is where we were at the S1 run. This is now for S2, we're at this level. Okay. So the sensitivity here is a few 10 to the minus 22. So roughly a factor of 10 better. The Hanford ones are slightly off this. In S2, they're about a factor of 2 worse. What you do is you divide by the number of interferometers at the site, because the crews are about the same size and they commissioned two more machines. The neutron star range for S2 has now gotten well out of the Milky Way to where we could see stuff out at Andromeda. So we're picking up now a number of other galaxies in these runs. And that was the run completed in April. So what are the future plans for these detectors? One is to improve the reach of the initial LIGO detector. We're still about a factor of 20 away from the design sensitivity of those detectors. We still have, of the 100 servo loops on most of the machines, about 15 of them that aren't engaged yet. And so that work has to be done to help stabilize them. And that work will proceed over the next year or two. The Virgo detector has not been mentioned a lot, and that's because they're still in a commissioning phase. They've been working very hard and making steady progress commissioning that detector in the corner station of the Virgo facility as they've been building out the arms. Things are now coming to a stage where we expect within about a year that the Virgo detector will come online and be able to join the worldwide network. And in the meantime, GEO 600 and TAMA 300 will continue striving for their own design sensitivities. Those will typically be lower because of the shorter lengths of the detectors, but nonetheless, for big sources, those will be important things. The VAR Group collaboration, IGEC, also expects to continue improving detectors. And when Virgo comes online, they hope to be running in coincidence with the laser detectors. An important thing that's been done over time is that LIGO and Virgo agreed many years ago, and it's since been adopted throughout the community, that everybody writes their data in a standard format. So it's very easy to go and trade data among the different groups and work on joint analyses. In 2008, the advanced LIGO technology movement that's under development now is planning to be ready to actually have hardware that's installable to upgrade the LIGO detector. So if we get to the range of the initial LIGO for neutron in spirals, you can see that we're starting to pick up clusters of galaxies. So the Virgo cluster is the first of those. And that is about where the design sensitivity of LIGO 1, the initial LIGO, ends. But there's a program working to develop basically new hardware that will replace the LIGO 1 hardware, which is called Advanced LIGO. This will involve improved lasers. It'll involve probably sapphire, perhaps much better grades of fused silica for test masses. The suspensions, here's a picture of one of the suspension systems, will be of a type that's been pioneered by the people in GEO, and we're working jointly with them on solving a lot of technical problems for using that in the LIGO detectors. And the basic goal of all of this, you also see the signal recycling mirror. We're going to move to a signal recycling interferometer. The basic idea of all of this is to be able to take our initial instruments and get another order of magnitude in reach, more than order of magnitude. The numbers are that at the reach of the advanced LIGO, you could outdo a year of integrated running of the initial LIGO in terms of the probability of seeing events in a few hours. So that's the basic push, is to open up a wider band of frequencies, drive the low end of the band down to about 10 hertz, and also to be able to do shaping of, with that signal recycling mirror, you can do shaping of the noise spectrum. So you can have this one here, you can have that one there. You can move this peak where you want it. So that's the advanced LIGO program. As I said, plan is to be able to have installable hardware by 2008. The range of that is where you can start to see, when you look for neutron stars, again, the standard benchmark, you're looking over ranges where there's a lot of structure. And so you're seeing big pieces of the universe. And the other movement is to open up that new channel we talked about. We don't believe that Earth-based detectors will ever do much at frequencies below a few hertz. And the reason is that the Earth's gravity itself is very noisy. Some people talk about trying to understand that, map it, and remove it, but it doesn't sound highly likely. And so Earth-based detectors will pretty much be limited to a window that can go up fairly high in frequency, but is not going to go below a few hertz. The LISA detector, by going to space, has the advantage that it's gotten away from this gravitational noise. And by doing so, it can acquire the much lower band of frequencies that's necessary. So LISA is planned as a very, very large detector made up of three orbiting spacecraft that will exchange beams and do something akin to interferometry using transponders that basically detect an incoming laser beam, lock onto its frequency, and then inject or eject an outgoing laser beam of a comparable frequency. It will orbit roughly at the Earth's orbit, but about 20 degrees behind, in a very clever solution that keeps changing orientation but holds roughly the same distance configuration. And that's a picture of one of the spacecraft. The planning is underway for this. Right now, planning is for a demonstration mission of some of the drag-free satellite features that are necessary for this. And the hope is that this new window will start to open up with a launch 2011-ish, I'll say. So in summary, we're currently experiencing a rapid advance in the sensitivity of searches for gravitational waves. Certainly the most rapid that I've seen. I remember when the laser detectors would be hard pressed to detect things far outside the solar system, and they're now very rapidly growing in their range. We're very close to opening a new window of frequencies. So things look very, very promising in that respect. The other very promising feature is this idea born during years of the Cold War that nations would get together and cooperate and build this worldwide network of gravitational wave detectors is really become a reality. It's an infant reality, but it's actually working. And it's wonderful to see that that's been exercised now and to see the collaboration amongst all these international groups. I see a lot of promise for the future in that. And I believe the future will see the confrontation of a lot of nice theory with some real astrophysical observations that can put some constraints on things. And I think it looks to be a very promising future. So thanks very much for your attention.
Thank you very much, and we do have some time left for questions till 10 o'clock, so yes.
Okay, so if I understood you, you said that LIGO hopes to reach the design sensitivity in another year or so, and that's 2004, and the upgrade to the advanced LIGO is not until 2008. So
right.
That's 4 years from
what we need to do is get what we've promised we will do, okay, is we will get 1 year of integrated observation time in that time. We will likely get more, okay? But that's sort of, that was the promise, is that we would get the 1 year integration time. As soon as we fulfill that promise, we will cheat. And we will do anything we can to improve the sensitivity of the detectors beyond that. And we will do anything that we can to try to, you know, bring about an earlier integration of components of advanced LIGO in. An instance for instance is one of the limiting factors for our uptime in the science runs during S2 and S1 was that the Livingston detector is available about 40% of the time of a scheduled run. And when you work out the time when it's inoperable due to logging activities near the site and due to some trains that are known factors, it winds up that explains 50% of the outage. Okay, and so what we're doing in the early part of next year is to take an active vibration isolation system people have been working on for advanced LIGO and install that early at the Livingston site. And that will basically get the ground at Livingston to the quietness that we experience at the Hanford site. And so, you know, those are the types of cheats that we'll try to do to improve the sensitivity beyond that. The other thing is that our goal is to be able to run triple coincidence with about a 70% duty cycle, 70-75%. And our most steady machines do that now, you know, we need to get the rest of those servo systems in to pull that off. But nonetheless, there will be some times when we have to go in and do maintenance and stuff. We think that's not a big factor.
So to be clear on that, is the 2008 when the advanced LIGO you go into operation or when you shut down to do the last...
Well, the big uncertainty in all of this is when people actually say yes to the funding for the upgrade.
But leaving
that out, okay, the 2008 date was when LIGO 1 would start going, you know, detectors would start going off the air to install LIGO 2 components. Yes. They've worked a lot harder on the vibration isolation, is one thing, and that helps them. But they also have a lot of trouble with on time as they've improved the sensitivity of the system when there are nearby activities. So for instance, one of the things they were able to pull off, which in the U.S. I can't imagine doing, is being able to get construction contractors to actually hold off for a couple of months while they were doing this joint run. Okay, so they suffer a lot with it, but there are certain things that you can overcome. You can put more drive into your coils and stuff. Eventually that starts to bite you though, because you drive more noise when you do that. So they've worked a lot more on the vibration isolation. We have some people who came to us via Virgo who worked on low frequency isolation, and they've worked with the Tama people and actually installed some of that equipment that's operating in Tama. How hard it is to get a water permit and all the practical things you have to do to actually make a lab work. So those have been probably the biggest surprises. I think the amount of downtime we have in Livingston has surprised us. We felt that we had a design that would do better. We left provisions. You know, there were blocks of material that were basically spacer blocks to be able to add something later if need be. The problem is you have to invent those things, and so they hadn't been invented yet. So we were able to get started and put them in. But I think for the most part, most of the systems we have, things have just been hard, but not, shockingly new stuff. So. Yes. Oh, that's not true. But I guess I don't have one that. I don't have one that shows it. The way you have to read those is, at the low frequency side, I think at S1. We had a lot of noise at frequencies of 100 hertz, and the sweet spot, I think by S2, had moved down significantly towards 100 hertz from the previous run, and that's one of the reasons the ranges were able to go up as significantly as they are. We have limiting factors in those, right now, they come from basically two places. One is the angle control systems that we're using are these optical levers, which were originally intended to be used at DC, but not at higher frequencies. And so when we designed those, the actual metal piers that we have are these big robust piers that mount the lasers and detectors on them. We're not designed with the intention that you'd worry about resonances in the piers at, 50 hertz and 60 and 80 and 90. And so those piers vibrate too much, okay? And so that needs some work. And the other issues are issues that are within our control. They're just how much filtering do we do before digital to analog converters and stuff like that to optimize the noise. I think that's just control, what I call loopology. people who do the control loops and the configurations of those and understand the noise will be able to push those down pretty readily. But probably what it will mean is that we have to either redesign those piers or get the the interferometric wavefront sensing working better, which doesn't touch those piers, and then we can, in that case, avoid that and drive the frequencies down better. But there's no problem of seismic noise or anything directly coming in there.
Is the logging hose just when the concrete comes fall, or is also trucks being driven around?
I don't know. I don't think anybody really knows. One of the problems with logging is the way the industry works is you hire contractors and they do whatever they want. So they get paid when they deliver trucks of logs. And so we really don't have a good way of knowing what's going on out in the field. We just see the rumbling of it. And we're sensitive to the logging within about 10 kilometers of the site. And so, you know, it's not like you can look out the window and see what people are doing. But what we do know is that it correlates very well with, you know, if we look back in time and we know that these were days when the loggers were out, you know, we see them on the seismometers. But we don't know if it's the trucks over the rutted roads or the actual felling of the trees that's creating the principal problem.
Well, we thank you again.